a full first day, a full plate.
I'm going to be issuing some of the first executive orders and directives to help restore that faith in government, from rebuilding our economy to protecting and defending the United States. I'm instituting a pay freeze, a clean break from business as usual. New rules on lobbying alone, the Freedom of Information Act, transparency, and the rule of law. That's a pretty good place to start.
The new president breaks with the past in 20 million ways in his first full day in office. One day down, 1,460 to go. They come from moment to moment, day to day. You know, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 22nd, and I know what one of those things were
things.
On that list of 20 million. He had to get sworn in again.
That's right. 20 million.
Did 20 you hear that?
One. Yes, indeed. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. Today, we're going to take a look at why President Obama was sworn in again last night. Also, the Caroline Kennedy Senate nomination that wasn't, and people in Nashville are voting today on an English-only proposal. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
The fighting has stopped in Gaza, but there is much to be done there. Here's UN Relief Coordinator John Holmes after a Gaza tour.
We've seen a school blown up. We've seen a flour mill hit. These are things which are terrible to see, profoundly shocking, and have profound implications for the economic future of Gaza. So that's why there's such a huge job to do.
The UN says the rebuilding of the estimated tens of thousands of buildings will cost billions of dollars. Diplomats on all sides are now at work keeping the ceasefire going there. Top Israelis are meeting in Egypt and Europe. Borders and tunnels are sticking points. There's pressure on Israel to open border crossings so more supplies can get into Palestinians. Israel wants a shutdown of the tunnels into Gaza used to smuggle the weapons. Bit of low-level violence there. An Israeli gunboat off Gaza opened fire. Israel says it did so to deter a Palestinian ship that strayed out of bounds.
And as many have noted, President Obama does have a lot to do and do it quickly. Today, he's expected to order the Guantanamo Bay prison camp closed within a year. He's already ordered a halt to military trials there, and this fulfills a campaign promise. President Obama is also freezing pay for senior White House staffers and ordering government agencies to make more information public. And by the way, President Obama is so totally the president, like two times over. Thanks, Mark. President Obama and Chief Justice Roberts redid the oath of office last night, and this was just to be safe after the botched swearing-in at the inauguration. The sequel went off just fine, we're told. We'll talk to Takeaway pal Todd Zwillick to get more. Oscar nominations come out later this hour, and we'll let you know who they pick.
A business story. Sony predicts a net loss for the year's first in nearly 15 years. And the Dow and the S&P are poised to open down this morning after a big bounce yesterday. Lots of people talking about the word Obama used on Tuesday, non-believers. You heard it. But whether you're a believer or a non-believer, did it make you feel more included or what? We want to hear what you think. How did Obama's mention of atheists and other people of I guess not other people of faith, atheists and people of faith make you feel? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So the faces of the Obama administration are being assembled down in Washington, confirmation hearings all over Capitol Hill, and the faces of the current Congress are also being assembled, and one face is clearly out. Caroline Kennedy is officially out of the New York Senate race to fill Hillary Clinton's seat, who vacated that seat yesterday. She's now Secretary of State. It was an evening of conflicting reports on whether Kennedy was in or out, many reports suggesting that Patterson had decided to pick her, but she cited personal reasons in a brief statement, which was confirmed very early this morning, saying she's taking herself out of contention. It's a startling development for the political world, certainly an interesting and unexpected cap on the career of Caroline Kennedy, who will go back into her relatively private life. Joining us to talk about all of this, Washington and the New York end, is Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show right here on WNYC in New York, and Todd Zwillick, our friend from Washington at Capitol Hill Connection. Todd Zwillick, are you there?
Yes, hi.
And Brian, thanks for being in the studio.
Hey, John.
Let's begin with the Patterson-Kennedy story. It appeared as though Governor Patterson had chosen Kennedy, and then it appeared as though Carolyn was taking herself out of the race. How related are these two things, and how was the sort of roller coaster we saw last night an indication that maybe things were or weren't coordinated?
Well, maybe they weren't coordinated. It was a funny night in the newsroom because the New York Post and the New York Times were saying she was going to drop out, and then there was another source who said she wasn't going to drop out. But, John, I think on one level this is really very simple. Caroline Kennedy auditioned and didn't get the job. She didn't show the charisma of a talented politician. She didn't show the deep knowledge of a committed policy wonk. If she had made a good first impression, I think she would be the senator from New York today.
Well, a lot of us here in New York understand the kind of blowback and that sort of auditioning process that happened. But for the rest of the country, what sort of lack of enthusiasm or reaction did she get as she attempted to test the waters here in New York?
Yeah, well, what happened? What went wrong? Because she started off on such a high note.
Well, she is Caroline Kennedy. But I think that something needs to be said about that, too, because, you know, there's a generational context here. Caroline Kennedy is the daughter, maybe a lot of our listeners don't know this, of President John Kennedy. Baby boomers know that, like they know that John Lennon was a Beatle. But for many younger Americans, it's like, which Kennedy is that? Caroline Kennedy is who again? You know, so she's led a relatively private life, and she had to come out and make an impression.
Although it was sure magic when she stood up with Uncle Teddy and endorsed Barack Obama during the campaign. That magic did not strike for her.
No, and it didn't translate for whatever reason. Look, there was immediate blowback from people in the New York political sector who thought that they or their colleagues in the House of Representatives, perhaps, should have gotten the job. One New York
Caroline Maloney, there would have been one idea.
Yeah, and these are not household names across the country either. But one New York congressman, Gary Ackerman, immediately compared Caroline Kennedy's qualifications to J-Lo's.
Right.
He said J-Lo's a celebrity too, but she's not qualified for the U.S. Senate, which is not to really compare their qualifications, but just to say that Caroline Kennedy had not been toiling in the fields of policy or politics, so she needed to come out and prove that she was for some reason going to be this big star in the Senate, more than a Caroline Maloney or any of the other members of the New York House delegation or political sector, and she just didn't do it.
And the other part of this was how the governor perhaps handled it, right?
The governor is still handling it. We're supposed to be in the new age of open, transparent government, right? Day two of the new transparency. But this whole sorry episode was and still is a lesson in backroom secrecy. Kennedy had always shied away from public life, but she was an immediate front runner because of her connections, because, frankly, Barack Obama wanted her. And frankly, apparently, Mayor Bloomberg wanted her.
And even Charles Schumer, the junior senator, had expressed a preference for Caroline Kennedy. Now, where does this leave Patterson? I mean, if it is true that he was going to choose Kennedy, it seems like he was doing the bidding of those powerful New York politicians. But where does he stand now, and does he emerge from this stronger or weaker?
I think he could emerge from this stronger, even though he seemed to fumble it along the way. I mean, we should have a New York U.S. senator already in New York. It's an embarrassment to David Patterson that it's gone on this long. Hillary Clinton now is the Secretary of State, and that seat is vacant. What if they have to take a big vote this afternoon?
Well, let's find out. Todd Zwillick, are they going to have to take a vote this afternoon? And what's the reaction down there that all of a sudden there's not going to be a Kennedy from New York in the Senate, apparently?
If you're a woman who wants to sue for pay discrimination and you're past the existing statute of limitations, there will be a big vote today because they're voting on that Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Equity Act in the Senate. That's part of the early Democratic agenda. This happened so late last night, John, that there hasn't been a whole lot of reaction off of Capitol Hill. I think that the Senate Democratic leadership is probably huddling and probably making some calls to Patterson. But I think it's interesting, and Brian, I'd be interested to hear what you think about this. Caroline Kennedy took herself out of the running. But the way in my eyes that these things usually work is the governor or the appointer decides that the person under consideration is not going to get it, and they're allowed to save face and take themselves out of the running. There were several vice presidential candidates. Back when Barack Obama hadn't picked a VP candidate yet, there were several of them who, quote, took themselves out of the running. And what that meant was Obama went and said, thanks for playing. It's not you. Save face and take yourself out of the running.
Understood, Brian. Do you think that's possible here? I don't believe that.
I don't have sources to tell me yes or no. I think it does smack of that. I think, you know, when she says she's taking herself out of the running for personal reasons, doesn't it sound like, well, here is another politician who is going to spend more time with her family?
Except in one instance, that's not the case. I mean, here, this would be a total break with Caroline Kennedy's life. I mean, she's lived this private life. She would be looking at, based on the blowback she got, she'd be looking at 2 years of a tough Senate term and then running
right. A
hard race. She must have looked at this and said,
She may have looked
at this.
I have no idea either. I don't have sources on this. Yeah. I think it really could have been either way. But I don't think it was because her Uncle Ted is sick.
Right,
I think,
right,
if anything, that would have been an inspiration for her to try to get the seat to follow in the family tradition.
Mm-hmm. Todd Zwillick, was there any anticipation down in Washington? I know last night this broke late, so there's no reaction. But was there any anticipation down in Washington among the Democrats that Caroline Kennedy would be joining the fray?
No one had gone that far. You know, people have been pretty much preoccupied with Roland Burris. Remember him?
Right. Senator and, Roland Burris.
Senator Roland Burris. And by the way, yesterday, Al Franken and Senator in Purgatory, former Senator Norm Coleman, were both in the Capitol, both hanging around the Senate.
And we've got a Colorado senator.
Yeah, with their respective caucuses. You know, Hillary Clinton didn't resign her seat until she was confirmed. I don't know that anyone was necessarily expecting Patterson to name a successor until Hillary officially resigned that seat, and she didn't do so because she wasn't going to risk something going wrong and with her Secretary of State nomination and then not have a seat in the Senate. So
right,
that's
but
now
Todd,
done.
Let me jump in and say that Patterson, as of when Hillary Clinton was obviously going to be confirmed, is still saying he's got a list of about 10 qualified candidates.
It just makes him look so indecisive here when he has all the power. It's sort of the opposite of Blagojevich, that's for sure.
right.
That might be a good thing.
Yeah, which might be a good thing, exactly. So, you know, any sort of, before we go, we'll get off the Caroline Kennedy story for just a moment. In the business that picks up on Capitol Hill this morning, any sort of reaction to Barack Obama's clear set of marching orders out of the White House yesterday?
Okay, so you've got the big one, of course, is you've got the executive order closing Guantanamo Bay within a year. Nobody's surprised about that. It was a campaign promise. Now the question becomes what to do with these detainees, 250 or 260 or so detainees. Nobody really wants to just turn them loose. Then again, almost nobody wants a new maximum security detention facility, you can't even call it a prison, in their state or in their district. So nobody seems to want it, and nobody seems to know quite what to do with these detainees. Interestingly, there is one member of the House who said, go ahead and put it in my district. I've only got a minimum security prison in my district. I'd love to have a maximum.
Who is that?
Jack Murtha.
Jack Murtha. Oh, that's great. Oh, thanks, Todd. Let's gang up on Brian here for a moment before we go. Who do you think is going to be the senator?
Well, I guess they say it's likely to be Andrew Cuomo, which would make political sense for David Patterson, who wants to run for his own election in 2010. And Cuomo is considered to be the strongest challenger.
He's the attorney general here in New York.
Andrew Cuomo, son of former Governor Mario Cuomo, who is the state attorney general. Do you have time for a little bit of bizarre context about New York state politics?
Always.
Do we have this Patterson clip about Schumer to play? Can we play it?
Fire it.
I propose that the Senate seat Senator Schumer a second time. Look at what we saved. He doesn't need another office. He doesn't need any additional staff. He does the work of two. Let Charles do it. That's my idea. And now here he is, New York's first and second senator, senior and junior, Senator Chuck Schumer.
Those laughs get quieter and quieter as the time goes on. Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show, thanks so much. And Todd Zwillick, thanks as always. Lots to think about there. Thanks, guys.
We'll be right back. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So one mention of the word non-believers by Barack Obama in his inaugural address, and everyone's talking.
I am motivated to do good, but not by a belief in God. And all the mention of God I find very alienating to my identity. So his inclusion of non-believers meant a lot to me.
Whether you're a believer or a non-believer, we want to hear what you think. How did Obama's mention of atheists make you feel? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And now we're heading to Nashville, Tennessee, where it could become the largest city in the country to make English the mandatory language for all government business. And that could happen today.
Basically, this is an insurance policy to the future to make sure our council meetings, boards, and commissions are done in English.
That's Councilman Eric Crafton, who hopes today voters will pass the measure that would mean marriage licenses, parking tickets, court summons, or any other government business could only be written and responded in English. Joining us for more on the story is reporter Blake Farmer of WPLN. Good morning, Blake.
Good morning, Dora.
We don't necessarily think of Nashville as a bastion of immigrants and multiple languages. How did this proposal come up?
Yeah, perhaps people are surprised. I mean, the foreign-born population in Nashville has really grown a lot over the past decade or so. A lot of people consider it a new destination city. Some estimates are that 1 in 10 are foreign-born in Nashville. So you've got Hispanics, but also a large Kurdish population and refugees from Sudan and Burundi. You've kind of got a corridor of town around Nolensville Road where most of these populations are gathered. You've got an Ethiopian restaurant sitting next to a Somali coffee shop. So with all these immigrants in town, we've got some city services offered in other languages, but mostly Spanish. You know, it's as simple as a city-issued trash can will tell residents to put out trash on Monday and on Lunes.
So how did this proposal to come up to make Nashville an English-only city?
Yeah, so Councilman Eric Crafton, who we just heard at the top, he introduced a city ordinance to do the same thing back in 2006. And he actually introduced this in Japanese from the floor of the Metro Council. It's a language he picked up in the Navy while he was stationed there.
And Blake, we actually have a little bit of it. Let's take a listen.
Minasan, konbanwa. Shinjitsu, watashi ga teishutsu shita.
Blake, that sounds quite theatrical to introduce it in Japanese. What was his point?
Yeah, so his point is that there's no city law that requires him as a councilman to do his business with the city council in any language, including English. So, you know, he knows Japanese. He was stationed there while I was in the Navy. He actually also has a wife who is Japanese. So it kind of gives him this perspective on the language issue that says, you know what, I learned the language when I was in another country, and immigrants who are here need to operate and do business in our language. So it eventually passed in 2007, a vote by the Metro Council. But the mayor at the time, Bill Purcell, vetoed the ordinance, which is very rare to have a mayoral veto. But then Eric Crafton went out, collected more than 12,000 signatures, and got this thing on a ballot and up for a special election, and that's where we are today.
There's certainly been a lot of debate there in Nashville. Let's listen to some voters as to what they had to say about it.
I'd rather see us find ways to encourage people and educate people to learn the language rather than discouraging them from being here.
I don't think the government should be forced to give specific help to a person just because they won't learn English.
So clearly two opposite ends of the spectrum there. But generally, how is this proposal polling there in Nashville? And what's the expectation as to whether or not this will pass?
It's hard to know exactly with the polling. I mean, we're not talking about huge budgets on either side. The folks who are opposing this have raised about $285,000. The folks who are supporting it, somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000. So not a lot of money out there for polling. But I hear from the folks opposing this that their internal polling, that they're not making too public, it's about 50-50. And so we're really going to have to wait and see tonight what it's like. Now, on the national level, when you go out with the question, do you support making English the official language of the United States, that polls anywhere from 75 to 85% of folks. But there are a lot of local issues and a lot of legal problems and headaches that this could cause. And so that may swing the vote and make it a little bit closer here in Nashville.
And one of those would be the cost. The special election is costing north of $300,000, and then you just point out that the law itself sounds a little vague, so it's not going to be clear exactly how it will be applied, which would suggest perhaps lawsuits, which cost more money. I mean, quickly, how much of the cost has that been part of the discussion?
Cost has been a big part of the discussion. Eric Crafton has said, you know, this is a fiscally responsible move to protect the city from any time in the future having to provide every city service in multiple languages. Right now, Metro government uses this thing called the language line. It's basically an interpreter on the other end of the line that if somebody comes up to a service center and can't speak English, they can get somebody on the phone. 172 languages at their fingertips right there. The city only spends about $112,000 doing that right now, and a lot of that could be exempt for health and safety reasons, which are built into this proposal. So it's pretty hard to make the case this is going to save the city much money.
Okay, Blake Farmer, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Blake Farmer was coming to us from WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee.
I'd love to hear the Grand Ole Opry in Japanese. I'd love them to do the whole Grand Ole Opry show.
You probably could get that
in Japanese.
Could probably get that done. But you know what? There are about a dozen cities that actually have that English-only law in the country. So it's actually a growing movement. We'll see what happens in 2009. But right now, we're going to get headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello, good morning. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Barack Obama is definitely the president now. Chief Justice John Roberts re-administered the presidential oath to him last night, just to be sure. He botched the word order when giving it on Tuesday. The White House counsel Greg Craig said the do-over was just to be extra cautious. President Obama is busy making changes this week. He's expected to sign an executive order today that will close Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. A draft of the order circulated yesterday. The president has already ordered a suspension of military cases at Guantanamo. Hamas says that it won't take part in reconciliation talks with its rival group Fatah. They also want to be sure that the group doesn't get any donations to reconstruct Gaza. Hamas also says it will send a delegation to Cairo this weekend to consolidate a ceasefire put in place on Sunday. Two men have been sentenced to death in China in connection with the tainted milk scandal. Another dairy boss got life in prison. Milk tainted with an industrial chemical is blamed for killing six children and sickening nearly 300,000 others. And China, the world's biggest economy, has recorded its slowest rate of growth for 7 years, so it's down to 9% from 13%, and that was from over 12 months ago. And just counting down to the half hour, we're expecting to see and hear about the Oscar nominations for this year's Oscars ceremony, and I will bring those to you as soon as we get them.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Discussions of faith and politics are hardly unusual in this day and age. And of course, whether you were a believer or a non-believer, you got mentioned in Barack Obama's inauguration speech this week. Whether you are a believer or non-believer, how did Obama's mention of non-believers make you feel? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org, or perhaps another word stood out for you. You can call us and tell us your story. So it was all there on the podium on Inauguration Day. You had Lincoln's Bible. You had Rick Warren giving the invocation. You had Joseph Lowry giving the benediction. There were mentions of God and symbolism in the oath. It's an American paradox, though. The separation of church and state is in the Constitution, yet God is all about the pageantry. And when Obama stood up to speak, he mentioned the religion of Muslims.
To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
And described a patchwork of religions in the United States.
We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of this earth.
Well, certainly with that beginning, the Barack Obama administration is shaped by all kinds of issues of faith. Randall Balmer joins us. He's a professor of American religious history at Barnard College and the author of God in the White House. He joins us from Atlanta. Randall, thanks for joining us.
Hey, John, how are you?
So, first of all, there was a lot going on in the inauguration if you were a person of faith and certainly understand the history of religion and politics in the United States. But the mention of non-believer, how important or unprecedented is that in your view?
Well, it's pretty unprecedented, but I think it reflects a kind of widening circle. If you look through American history, despite the presence of Jews in New Amsterdam in 1654, it was primarily a Christian nation. And then in the early part of the 20th century, we began talking about the Judeo-Christian tradition to account for Jews. And then in 1955, sociologist Will Herberg talked about Protestant Catholic Jew. Then we came to the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and now we're widening the circle further to account for this gorgeous diversity in American society.
It's interesting that the trend has been, if you go back to the framers, who were very, very secular. I mean, it's full of Unitarians and Universalists who are a very secular denomination, and you've got Abraham Lincoln, who had no official affiliation, religious affiliation,
right.
Thomas Jefferson the same, Andrew Johnson the same. We've moved full circle to a nation of strong faith-based invocations in politics, but to mention non-believers seems like a real reversal here. What do you think the message is?
Well, I think President Obama was trying to say, listen, you're all part of this, as he called it, the patchwork quilt, and I think he wants to be inclusive. I think it also reflects, or at least is indicative, of a new style of governing where he invites everybody to the table, not merely the sort of echo chamber of his own people and his own ideological perspective.
Well,
and I find it a very welcome innovation on his part.
Well, some of our listeners definitely got the message.
This is Joe from New Jersey, and I'm very glad that Barack Obama mentioned non-believers, because I think there's a lot more of us out there than people realize, and there's way too much God in government these days.
So, Randall Balmer, actually, there are a lot fewer non-believers out there than people realize. I think the number of people who actually explicitly say they are non-believers is a tiny minority in America. Explain.
That's right. And I'll circle back to your initial point. I think it's precisely because of the First Amendment, precisely because the government has stayed out of the religion business, that we have such a vibrant and vital and salubrious religious life in this country. Because the state, the founders in their wisdom, decided not to have a state church, not to have an established religion, we have a kind of free marketplace for religious life in America. And to extend the economic metaphor, throughout American history, various religious entrepreneurs have been competing in that marketplace, keeping it a very vibrant and very much part of our lives.
So let's talk then about what this means going forward in terms of policy. I mean, is this sort of a token mention to project simply diversity, or is the explicit acknowledgement of non-believers something that will have policy implications?
Well, it's hard for me to imagine exactly what sort of policies would stem from that, but I think it's more an indication of the president's frame of mind, that he understands that there is a great deal of diversity in American society. And by the way, I'm sure that maybe some Jains and Sikhs and Buddhists wish that their names had been mentioned in his laundry list as well.
Actually, Randall, the Pew Forum did a survey not long ago, and basically when you added up the number who identified as atheists or agnostic, it was 25% of the population. You believe that?
I find that a little hard to believe. It may reflect more likely, in my judgment, that I'd have to look at the survey more carefully, but it may reflect that a lot of people don't affiliate themselves or don't consider themselves part of any religious tradition. What I hear a lot these days is people say, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. And by that, they mean all sorts of rather eclectic beliefs and practices.
Well, let's take that apart a little bit. Who then, in your view, is an actual non-believer versus somebody who's just unaffiliated?
Well, I think people who are self-identify as humanists, the Ethical Culture Society, for example, is a classic example of a non-religious group, explicitly non-religious, although what I find fascinating when I visit their gatherings is it has a lot of the trappings that you might associate with even a Protestant worship service. People who proclaim themselves to be atheists and agnostics and are rather resolute about not having any sort of religious affiliation. I suppose those folks would fit into that category. But I think Americans are religious.
So thanks for joining us. Randall Balmer is a professor of American religious history at Barnard College and author of God in the White House. Thanks, Randall. And now headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Just had some new economic numbers out this last 20 minutes or so. The new home construction numbers sink to 550,000 in December. And since last month, they went down almost 19%. And the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week was more than expected, 589,000. That matches a 26-year high. Now, with about an hour to go before the open on Wall Street, the Dow futures were mostly flat. It looks like they may be going down just a little bit. And Japanese electronics maker Sony is predicting a net loss for the year, and that will be its first in nearly 15 years. Speaking at a news conference in Tokyo, Sony's chief executive Howard Stringer says it's his responsibility to turn the company around.
We are in the worst economic depression in my lifetime. Economic recession, we're not supposed to call it a depression, yes, but it feels pretty depressing. We have to move in a hurry, and that's our responsibility and my training.
The electronics company blames the loss on weak sales and a strong yen. And by contrast, computer giant Apple is celebrating a record first quarter. The company announced yesterday that strong iPhone and MacBook sales led to a big profit increase. And the rosy earnings news comes amid an SEC review. The agency says that Apple may have misled investors about the health of CEO Steve Jobs.
And Heath Ledger nominated for an Oscar, among others, in L.A. going on now. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And we know the North Pole is warming because it's a big chunk of ice and you can see it melting. But the South Pole, Antarctica, is actually a chunk of rock with a lot of ice on it. And so detecting warming down there is much more difficult. But global warming skeptics now say that Antarctica is not a place they can point to as an argument against global warming, because scientists using advanced techniques have determined that indeed the South Pole is also warming up. And joining us to talk about it is NASA climate scientist Drew Schindel here in New York. Drew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what are the challenges of detecting average temperatures across Antarctica because it's a continent, not a piece of ice?
Well, the main challenge is that it's a continent that's about half again as large as the whole United States, and we only have a few weather stations that are almost all at the coasts. So up until recently, when we've launched satellites, we haven't had any information on what's going on inside.
So based on this new information, what's the scale of the warming you've noticed down there, and does it match what's going on at the North Pole?
Well, now that we've used the satellite information to fill in what's going on over the rest of the continent, we see this picture where the whole continent has been warming over the past 50 years, especially the western portion. And the rate of warming is roughly the same as most of the other areas, most of the other land areas on Earth. It's not quite as rapid as the North Pole, which has been probably about the fastest warming place on the planet, but it's getting close.
People talk about the implications for global warming at the North Pole as causing a rise in ocean levels because there is so much solid water becoming liquid. Is that a different situation at the South Pole?
Well, actually, what we worry about in the north is not so much the sea ice, which has been melting extremely rapidly, and we've got these very dramatic pictures of. We worry about in the north the melting of the ice in Greenland, because, again, that's above sea level rather than floating in the ocean. So if it melts, it raises ocean temperatures. Antarctica is the same as Greenland in that respect, in that if it melts, it increases sea level. And, in fact, there's much more water trapped in the ice sheets of Antarctica. So
wow.
Even if this western part that we're seeing this very rapid warming, if that part alone melts, that's enough to raise sea level by about 20 feet worldwide.
Well, not that there's much of a silver lining in this, but is there any chance that they did a sequel to that Penguin movie, that they'll be huddled together in a more tropical setting than the freezing cold? Is it going to affect wildlife like the polar bears in the north?
There's not as much chance of that, because Antarctica is in general so cold that the average temperature is tens of degrees below zero. So if it rises by a few degrees, it's still quite cold. Penguins should stay happy.
The penguins should stay happy, and I guess the average is still 58 degrees below zero in Antarctica. There's a great map that NASA did that shows this. So where can you find that online?
A good place to look is the Earth Observatory at NASA.
And that's available online at just Google NASA, and you can find it online. It'll also be linked on our website.
Exactly. Type in NASA and Earth Observatory, and you'll get all kinds of great pictures like that.
Especially seeing the scale of warming that scientists have determined is now going on at the South Pole in Antarctica, where there's more water to raise the level of the oceans than is the case in the North Pole. We learned from Drew Schindel, NASA climate scientist who joined us from New York. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 22nd, and Femi Oke has the headlines.
Good morning again. 30 minutes to the top of the hour. New violence around Gaza this morning, but at a low level that doesn't appear to threaten the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. An Israeli gunboat off Gaza opened fire. Israel says it did so to deter a Palestinian ship that strayed out of bounds. Today, top Israelis meet in Egypt for talks on extending the ceasefire. Pakistan has a suspect in custody linked to the 2005 London Transit bombings. Pakistani police swooped in after a tip from the United States. The suspect is a Saudi citizen, one of seven Al-Qaeda suspects captured in a raid. President Obama and Chief Justice Roberts redid the oath of office last night. They both misplaced the word faithfully at the inauguration. And since it's spelled out in the Constitution, they thought it was a good idea to say it right just to be safe. The second time around, all went well. Computer chip manufacturer Intel plans to cut 6,000 jobs. It's scaling back production at facilities in Oregon and Silicon Valley and closing some test sites in the Philippines and Malaysia. Intel says that not all employees will be cut and some will be moved to other plants. Lawmakers voiced reservations yesterday about a deal that would allow the Italian car giant Fiat to purchase a 35% stake in U.S. automaker Chrysler. And the Treasury gave Chrysler a $4 billion loan earlier this month. Just a few moments ago, the Oscar nominations were broadcast. So, Best Picture. What are your suggestions, Adora?
Slumdog Millionaire.
Yes.
Frost Nixon.
Absolutely.
I don't know what else.
The Reader, Milk, and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Great. That mirrors the Golden Globes to a certain extent. Yeah.
And that one actually got 30 nominations, the most nominated film so far.
Wow.
February the 22nd will be when all will be revealed for the Oscars.
Well, thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
We're going to head to Africa now. Several thousand Rwandan soldiers are now in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where United Nations peacekeepers are monitoring the newest development in this long-lasting African war. Conservative estimates say the war has cost the lives of over 5 million people the past decade. But this time, the Congolese government said it had invited the Rwandan army in to help disarm rebel forces, including forces they claim are responsible for the 1994 Rwandan genocide. We spoke earlier with journalist Jeffrey Mutagoma in Kigali. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what are government officials saying about this latest offensive with the Rwandan army?
Well, not much has really been said on the side of the Rwandan government, because they say that the Congolese government invited them to come and take part in the disarmament process, and that it's only the Congolese government who will be talking about what is happening in their country. But the Rwandan government so far has not made any official comment on it.
Is there any sense among those who are discussing this at this point, besides the government, that there is some hope that perhaps hostilities will be brought to an end?
Indeed, there is, because yesterday when I was moving around the streets of Kigali, I found almost every group that was discussing around town, you know, talking about it, saying that now that the Rwandan government has sent its troops there, and they're going to disarm the Hutu rebels in the eastern part of the country, which has been a major reason why Rwanda and Congo have been disagreeing in the past, that now peace is going to come back between the two countries. They are saying that, some of them are saying that it was long overdue, that if perhaps the Rwandan troops had gone there in agreement with the Congolese government and, you know, dealt with this whole issue from the beginning, perhaps it would have stopped earlier.
That was Jeffrey Mutagoma reporting from Kigali, Rwanda. We also spoke to BBC World Affairs correspondent Mark Doyle, and I asked him about the complicated story of how the Rwandan government gets a chance to go after those they say are responsible for the genocide, and the need for the Congolese government to break up the Tutsi rebel forces that have been fighting since August.
There are two elements to this. I've visited Congo many times over the years, and what's happened is an absolutely seismic shift in the politics of the region. For the Congolese to invite the Rwandan army into their country openly and officially like this is just absolutely extraordinary to anybody who's been in the region. That's because Rwanda and Congo have been basically fighting a proxy war for the last 15 years, and for some of that period, they've been fighting an actual war, and Rwandan troops invaded Congo twice to change the government. Now, what's happened is that the Congolese government has realized that its army, which is in such disarray, cannot deal with the rebels in the east, either the Tutsi rebels, who are opposed to the Congolese government, or the Hutu rebels, who are Rwandan, and the Congolese government has used as allies in the past. So they've invited the Rwandans in, but it's a situation which is replete with political danger for the government in Kinshasa and for the Rwandan government itself.
Can you describe how the governments are explaining what this offensive is before we get to some of the details that you just mentioned?
Well, as you've heard from Jeffrey there, the Rwandans are not saying very much at all, except that they've been invited by the Congolese and that they will be under Congolese command. Now, no one believes that, because the Rwandan army is by far the most powerful army in the region, and the Congolese government army is in great disarray, not to say not very good army at all. So basically, this is a Rwandan operation. But the Congolese, to save face, are saying that they're in charge of it, that they've invited the Rwandans in as military observers. Well, 3,000 or 4,000 military observers with AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades. I'm not sure that many people are going to believe that. They're there to deal with the Hutu rebels, and that's what the Rwandans intend to do.
And can you talk a little bit more about why you believe it is an explosive situation? Clearly, there's been ongoing fighting there between the rebels and the Congolese government since August. I suspect that most Congolese are not thrilled to hear, in addition to that, now you've got the Rwandan forces in country.
Well, exactly. I mean, you have to distinguish between the different rebel groups, I'm afraid. It is a little bit complicated, but to simplify it, basically, there are ethnic Tutsi rebels who are allies of the Rwandan government, which is Tutsi-dominated. And those Tutsi rebels, the Congolese Tutsi rebels, have been fighting against the government in Kinshasa. Meanwhile, you have Hutu rebels who are opposed to the government in Rwanda, who the Rwandan government says are still a threat to them. Now, the Rwandans will go in and deal with the Hutu rebels. Or at least they'll try to. They've tried it in the past, and it's just led to complete chaos. But that's what they say they're going to try and do. But meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, it appears that something is happening with the Rwandans potentially even dealing with the Tutsi rebels as well, which is perhaps the quid pro quo which the Congolese government has negotiated. So we'll have to wait and see. But the fact is that in the late 90s and early 2000s, Rwanda invaded Congo in order to try and deal with these Hutu rebels, and they signally failed to do so. They just hid in the forests, dug up the gold, created chaos, and the rebels are still there. So if the Rwandans couldn't do it by openly invading, it's most unclear what they can do in cooperation with the Congolese government, which, as I say, is not a particularly doesn't have a particularly strong army at all.
Last and quick question to you, Mark. Do you agree with Jeffrey that perhaps, though, given all of these conflicting elements, that there is perhaps some hope for some resolution of some of them?
Yes, it is potentially a good thing if it leads to better relations between Congo and Rwanda. But in the past, initiatives like this, I'm afraid, have just led to more chaos.
That's Mark Doyle, BBC World Affairs correspondent, reporting from London.
And we've got a takeaway from a man of the cloth this morning.
Listen, you're all part of this, as he called it, the patchwork quilt. And I think he wants to be inclusive. I think it also reflects, or at least is indicative, of a new style of governing.
Talking about Barack Obama is Randall Balmer, professor of American Religious History at Barnard College and author of God in the White House. Speaking, of course, about President Obama's mention of non-believers in his inauguration speech, which got a lot of you talking.
Hi, this is Taggart calling from Brooklyn. They were talking to me. I grew up as a minister's son in this last administration. I feel like we're slipping into the dark ages, so they were talking to me.
We're hearing from a lot of non-believers, and we also want to hear what you believers thought as well. Did Obama answer your prayers on Tuesday or strike fear when he mentioned non-believers? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. On our website, Judith Freed writes, as an 82-year-old non-believer, I was pleased at long last to be included in our new president's list of diverse faiths. Many non-believers do have faith in the ultimate possibility of decency for all human beings. According to the Pew Religious Study, says Jerry, those of us not affiliated with a religion, call us what you like, comprise the second largest group in the U.S., yet we're still included as an afterthought behind the relatively tiny Hindu, Muslim, and Jewish believers. I'm still not impressed as long as my use of reason to accomplish goals is an afterthought to those who rely on their particular mythology, Jerry says, to hope and pray for a change. Also on our website, takeaway.org, there's more on the new administration, the cabinet, and all the policies of President Obama as they emerge. We're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Listen to Randall Balmer again and subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
So, Wes Allison, Washington Bureau, St. Petersburg Times, you were one of four pool reporters witnessing the historic second swearing-in of Barack Obama, right?
That's right.
Nice. Kind of a smaller crowd than for the flubbed one on Tuesday. Uh-huh.
It is, and yep. Warmer, too, thank you.
Was everyone a little more relaxed with the smaller crowd?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Obama always looks relaxed. It's one of his things. And so he was sort of there. He was joking a little bit about the whole thing. And Chief Justice didn't say much, honestly. But, honestly, those of us in the pool, the four reporters there, we're kind of stunned. And suddenly, all of a sudden, like, boom, okay, here's the president of the Chief Justice Supreme Court.
Wow.
We're swearing in again.
So how long did it take, the swearing in, exactly?
Yeah, 25 seconds, actually. It took like 25 seconds.
And you're supposed to know stuff like that because you are a pool reporter. So here's another question. Did it appear in any way that Barack Obama was kind of annoyed to have to take time out of his busy first full day to have to swear in again?
You know, he didn't seem annoyed. He was just joking about it. You know, we walked in, he's sitting on the couch in the map room. It's just sort of a short settee, maybe you'd call it. And he said, just because we had such a good time the first time, you know, and kind of left it hanging. And that was kind of a good little joke there. And he got in and, you know, he made some cracks about it. He seemed very sanguine about it. He's not the kind of guy to get riled up. He didn't seem annoyed. Justice didn't say much, though. He seemed a little bit like, I mean, I kept thinking to myself, man, it has to be called back to the White House to do this again.
One cool customer, that Barack Obama. Wes Allison, thanks so much. But that's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 22nd, and I got to tell you, that vision is priceless. President Obama on the settee.
And a pool reporter seeing some real history for the first time. Good morning, Adora.
Yeah, I know, just among four reporters. Good morning, John, and good morning, everyone. We have the story about Caroline Kennedy. She's bowed out of the Senate race and using the tax code to influence your behavior. We'll explain that one. Those stories are coming up. First headlines.
So in a year, Guantanamo Bay could be closed. Just one of the things that Barack Obama promised to do yesterday. And he's freezing more than Gitmo.
During this period of economic emergency, families are tightening their belts, and so should Washington. And that's why I am instituting a pay freeze on the salaries of my senior White House staff.
All six-figure salaries are affected.
There's been low-level violence around Gaza, but a stop to fighting between Israel and Hamas is mostly holding so far. Top Israelis are in Egypt and Europe talking about how to keep it that way. Sustainability is on the mind of European Union commissioners. They are concerned about the sustainability of the ceasefire, and they are meeting today. An Israeli gunboat off Gaza opened fire today, Israel says, it fired to deter a Palestinian ship that strayed out of bounds. And two alarming economic reports are just in this morning. New weekly unemployment claims surged to their highest levels in more than a quarter century, and new home construction dropped more than 15% last month.
We've got the Oscar nominations. A few minutes ago, the Academy announced The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, Milk, The Reader, and Slumdog Millionaire are the Best Picture nominees. Heath Ledger got a posthumous supporting actor nomination for his role in The Dark Knight. Not a surprise there. Sony predicts a net loss for the year, the first in 15 years. And we want you to talk about non-believer, the one word Barack Obama used, perhaps the most controversial one, in his inaugural speech. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It was a roller coaster night of reports. Caroline Kennedy was out of contention to fill the heat. The Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's vacated Senate seat. Then she was in, then she was out. Finally, after midnight, Kennedy issued a statement citing personal reasons for stepping down. So who will New York Governor Patterson choose to replace Hillary Clinton as the state's second senator? Liz Benjamin is a reporter for the New York Daily News, and she joins us. She was in D.C. for the inauguration and is with us this morning. Good morning, Liz.
How are you?
Good. What happened? This fell apart so quickly. Initially, when Caroline Kennedy stepped in, most people thought that she would be a shoo-in, but it seems to have all gone downhill slowly and then quickly.
Yes, it was really quite something to see. I mean, over a course of weeks, she got in. She was considered the front runner. Then she made a bit of an upstate foray and wasn't really prepared, I don't believe, to speak to the media. And it all sort of went downhill from there. her rollout was not well managed, and more questions surfaced about whether or not she was indeed qualified, and a bit of a backlash over a question of her ascension and entitlement to the seat, when others had already been elected to positions that she had never held elected office and, you know, perhaps were more deserving of being elevated.
She cited personal reasons, but clearly there were a whole lot of political reasons.
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, yes, it's true that her uncle Ted Kennedy had a seizure and he's out of the hospital and reportedly doing okay and recovering, but he has been ill from a brain tumor for some time, which the family has known. That's no big surprise. So there's a lot of skepticism over whether or not that was indeed the issue, but personal reasons could mean anything. It doesn't necessarily mean his health. It could mean she personally thinks the thing was going badly. I don't know.
True.
We don't know what that means.
True enough.
But, you know, there's conflicting reports as to whether or not the governor was inclined to announce that he had selected her. He's supposed to make an announcement before Saturday, or by Saturday, rather.
It seems that Caroline, though, would have had to have faced an unbelievably challenging election campaign in 2 years. So I got to figure she looked at this as nothing easy at all.
Well, that's an interesting point. It's unclear. I mean, certainly Pete King, who's a representative from Long Island, a Republican, has said that he intends to run for the seat in 2010. Of course, in 2010, every single statewide office will be up in New York. And that's difficult because Governor Patterson, who himself was not elected to this particular office, as you, I'm sure everyone recalls, is very concerned about what the ticket will look like when he runs for the first time statewide for governor. So had he done this, whoever he picks is going to have a hard time, is what I'm trying to say. And the Republicans are not doing well in New York, so it's unclear how much they'll be able to muster a really serious campaign.
But clearly there must have been a lot of scrambling going on behind the scenes. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been this back and forth, these public comments and releasing of statements.
Oh, it was crazy. It was insane. I mean, I've never, in 10, 12 years of doing this, I've never seen anything like what happened last night.
So if the governor is now expected to announce his choice this Saturday, who is it likely to be, do you know?
Well, you know, that's interesting. We don't know. The governor has really had a fabulous time being coy about this and, of course, has garnered a lot of national media attention as well as sort of exhaustive coverage by the New York press. And while he was in Washington, you know, in a span of 7 hours in one day, went from having a good idea to having no idea to back having a good idea again as he gave various interviews to various media outlets. Andrew Cuomo, of course, in public polling, he's the state attorney general, former member of the Clinton administration, has been leading her, actually, among New Yorkers. But if he taps Attorney General Cuomo, then someone will have to be appointed to replace him by the legislature. And that would mean that almost everyone on the ticket in 2010 will be running for a seat for which they did not run originally.
So there is quite a lot of politics happening here in New York, and of course it's affecting what's happening where you are, Liz, in Washington. Liz Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us. She is a reporter for the New York Daily News.
And yesterday in Washington, it was Barack Obama on his first full day as president meeting the press. And first, he walked the walk.
During this period of economic emergency, families are tightening their belts. And so should Washington. And that's why I am instituting a pay freeze on the salaries of my senior White House staff.
A pay freeze for anyone making six figures or more. And he talked the talk.
Public service is a privilege. It's not about advantaging yourself. It's not about advancing your friends or your corporate clients.
And at his news conference, he delivered a promise.
We need to make the White House the people's house. And we need to close the revolving door that lets lobbyists come into government freely and lets them use their time in public service as a way to promote their own interests over the interests of the American people when they leave.
In a very short encounter with the press, he also talked about the Freedom of Information Act, greater openness in Washington, the end of any number of eras. Joining us now is Newsweek senior White House correspondent Richard Wolff to talk about what was a very active bully pulpit yesterday from Barack Obama. What do you make of it, Richard?
Well, he's sending some clear signals that that things have changed, that he's on the job. It was more symbolic than anything else. Remember, he's not going to save a whole lot of money by freezing the pay for these senior folks in the White House. But it is a good statement to send out when you're saying we've all got to tighten our belts. I think probably more important was the stuff about lobbying. He signed a couple of executive orders restricting what kind of work former lobbyists could do in his White House and the kind of work that ex-soon-to-be or future ex-White House staffers could do in terms of lobbying when they leave. So those are the kinds of things he talked about on the campaign. It's delivering on that promise and a sign of the start of what is going to be another busy day on day two today.
And he really widened out the number of people who are eligible for these kinds of lobbying restrictions, conflict of interest restrictions. And you couldn't have had a greater contrast from all the discussions 8 years ago when the Bush administration began of what Cheney's going to do with his Halliburton stock.
Right. Well, and it wasn't just that 8 years ago. Remember that actually for the first couple of weeks they were focused very much on the quote-unquote vandalism in the White House, the missing W's on the,
right.
on the typewriters. You know, that they're really trying to set a different tone from what we saw 8 years ago, and we're going to see that again today when it comes to Guantanamo Bay. And of course, he met with his military advisors, his national security folks yesterday, talking about a new direction in Iraq. So lots of efforts to deliver, at least early on this idea of change.
Is it activity that marks the contrast here? Is it the selection of issues that is happening? Or is it just simply the freshness of having a new face that seems to be such a morale booster as you look at these events in the early going?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. You know, moving to a timetable for withdrawal in Iraq is a huge shift. Halting the military commissions, the trials in Guantanamo Bay, is a big shift. These are substantive. On the other hand, we don't know. It's not a full resolution. We don't know the details of the withdrawal from Iraq. We don't know what's going to replace these trials, because these people are not going to be freed out of Guantanamo Bay, not all of them anyway. So it's a start, and it's important for them to make a start that is lots of activity to it, as you say. Remember, when you have 2 million people or close to that on the National Mall, the expectations are high for them to deliver quickly.
And I guess the question is, what's the methodology for keeping this sort of thing going? I mean, looking at Guantanamo Bay, what's the chance there, for instance, that it could get bogged down in some sort of dispute with Congress about the specifics of how it gets implemented?
Well, I think the dispute here is really legal. What kind of system is going to actually listen to the trials that they want to set up? Eric Holder, the incoming attorney general, if he is confirmed as we expect, has suggested that these will be trials in American courts and under regularly respected international norms. Well, they're going to have a problem with that, because so many of these interrogations will not meet any judicial standard whatsoever because of the use of coercive techniques and torture. So I don't think the problem is going to be with Congress. I think it's going to be with the courts about what's acceptable evidence. The vast bulk of the people in Guantanamo Bay, though, will be freed to their home countries, because these countries are now saying, we're ready to take them. We wouldn't do it for the Bush administration. We're going to do it for the new president.
Which is an interesting indication of the sort of foreign policy arrangements and fluidity that Barack Obama has to exploit at this point. Quickly, we talked to a pool reporter at the top of the hour, Richard, who actually witnessed that historic second swearing in. You weren't there, were you?
I was not there. Very few people. It's a source of some controversy because it was very restricted, and it was a moment of history. They may want to forget it, but it was a moment of history.
Well, I mean, you're an old White House hand. I mean, the pool report thing is usually a bit of drudgery, but I imagine you were a little bit jealous there, huh?
You know, jealous and also ashamed that there was no better recording than a handheld audio little device. People really should have had some cameras in there.
Oh, it's great. It's a great little detail, and I love talking about it with you. Richard Wolff, catching us up on everything on the first day of the Obama administration, Newsweek senior White House correspondent. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This morning we're asking you, what did you think, what did you feel when Barack Obama mentioned the word non-believer in his inauguration speech?
I am an atheist, and I was thrilled to hear President Obama give a little nod to non-believers. It actually gave me faith in the government, that is.
So what do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Well, the Obama administration is a believer in one thing. For those of you who aren't currency freaks, they're a believer in allowing the Chinese currency to float. It's currently pegged with the dollar, which means it moves in track in tandem with the dollar. But it came up yesterday in the hearings for Timothy Geithner, who wants to be Treasury Secretary. China needs to float its currency. The Obama administration says it's going to put pressure on China to do just that.
I do believe that it is a significant issue. As I said earlier, I believe it's important for the United States and for the global economy that our major trading partners operate with a flexible exchange rate system.
Flexible exchange rate system, that's code for floating the yuan. But China is already under pressure. The world's third biggest economy has recorded its lowest rate of growth for 7 years. The figure fell to 9% in 2008, and in the final quarter, growth fell sharply to less than 7%. Of course, the rest of the world would envy that. We spoke earlier with BBC correspondent in Shanghai, Chris Hogg. I asked about the growth issue and the Obama administration wanting China to float the yuan.
There couldn't be a worse time, really, to ask the Chinese to do this. Look, in November and December, exports started to fall from China. So anything that would make it more expensive for Chinese goods, Chinese-made goods or Chinese-assembled goods to be sold overseas just isn't going to wash with the leadership here. Plus, as we've seen from these figures that have come out today here in China, they're in trouble. Their economy is in trouble. And so I think it's very unlikely that they would respond at all positively to any kind of pressure to loosen up their currency rules.
In fact, Chris, the leverage goes the other way. Explain how China must now actually use its own cash resources to invest in its economy rather than buy U.S. debt and what that does to U.S.-China relations.
Well, yes. I mean, for years, when times were good, if you like, when the 5 years where China had double-digit growth, the excess profits that it made, the trillions of dollars it invested buying American government bonds. Now, one important point about this is it means that these two countries are very closely interlinked. So China doesn't want to do anything that would cause more problems in the U.S. economy because obviously it has a massive stake in the U.S. economy. And at the same time, America can't put a lot of pressure on China because China holds all this government debt. If President Obama wants to put in a new stimulus package, if he wants to grow the deficit, then America's going to look to other countries to try to fund that, and China will be one of the countries that they'll be looking to.
So the U.S. is more like the U.S. is more like Taiwan these days than it is like a superpower ordering China around. Finally, before we go, Chris, and I'm sorry to interrupt you there, what's the political instability issue that floats beneath the surface when Chinese growth and wealth begins to diminish?
Well, the way to think about the Chinese economy is it's a bit like a large elephant riding a bicycle. It needs to cycle as fast as possible to keep it upright. The faster it's going, the least likely it is to fall over. If it starts to slow, then it starts to wobble horribly. And if it falls over, there'll be a big crash, a big disaster, all sorts of things could go wrong.
And Chris, there are no training wheels on that bicycle that the elephant is riding, correct?
There are absolutely no training wheels, and that's why you have this real concern from the top leaders up in Beijing, very worried about social stability, telling officials the two priorities has got to be finding a job for migrant workers and for graduates.
Just keep that elephant on the bicycle. That's the advice from Chris Hogg, BBC correspondent in Shanghai, China, talking about growth declines in that country. Thank you, Chris.
That's about one of the funniest things I've ever heard, an elephant on a bicycle.
It's a great image.
Anyhow, a lot of people thought it was so fascinating when Barack Obama mentioned non-believers in his inaugural speech. They just keep talking about it.
I'm very happy to hear that he said non-believers. I feel in that middle group between those who follow the organized religion and those who don't believe. I have a very strong spiritual sense. I think that needs more attention because I am very, very strongly unaligned with organized religion. I respect non-believers. I have a great belief in the notion of God, but my God does not have a beard. He's not white. He's not humanoid. And leaving room for people who believe the way I do is really important, and we're probably dramatically undercounted.
Well, that's a conversation that's definitely going on from
Absolutely.
That inaugural speech.
Absolutely, and everyone has very strong opinions. Hugh Siegel writes an email to us saying, I couldn't believe that in the midst of all those invocations and benedictions and prayer meetings that Barack Obama addressed non-believers like me. God, when he said those words, I felt like I'd died and gone to heaven.
Oh, non-believer? I don't know about that. Speaking of heaven,
I believe that President Obama was getting at a very deep misconception in our society that you need to be religious in order to be moral. And I think as a philosopher that that is something that is mistaken. People do not have to have a religion to be a moral person.
We're getting the philosophers out of the
woodwork
at this point.
Philosophers, lots
yes,
of thoughts.
Indeed.
You really broaden the discussion. And whether you're a believer or a non-believer, we want to hear what you think. How did Obama's mention of non-believers make you feel? Does it matter? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Headlines now from Femi Oke.
Hello there. Good morning. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. During the campaign, President Obama made a promise to close Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Now, he's expected to sign an executive order today that fulfills that promise. A draft of the order circulated yesterday. The president already ordered a suspension of military cases there. Tuesday was the first time that Chief Justice John Roberts swore in a president. Yesterday was the second. He readministered the presidential oath to President Obama last night, and the White House counsel recommended a do-over of the oath just to be absolutely sure. The Chief Justice made a mistake in the word order when giving it on Tuesday. The World Health Organization says that more than 2,700 people have died in Zimbabwe's cholera epidemic, and that's a huge jump from last week. Some 50,000 others have been infected. The leader of the opposition MDC party in Zimbabwe, Morgan Tsvangirai, has been to see some of the cholera patients.
I've just had a visit, and I think you can see the pain of the people. But above all, I think you can also have witnessed the ongoing suffering of the people. And I can say that this suffering must end.
Morgan Tsvangirai is saying the way to end the suffering is to actually vote some of his or appoint some of his party into the cabinet. That wrangling has been going on since September of last year. And the WHO is calling on African leaders to put pressure on President Robert Mugabe to take action. Two people are facing death sentences in China for their part in the tainted milk scandal. Another got life in prison, and they're the first of 21 defendants to be sentenced. Milk tainted with the industrial chemical melamine is responsible for killing 6 children and sickening nearly 300,000 others. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It's almost as though that one word in Barack Obama's inaugural speech, non-believer, was in a different font or in all caps.
I thought it was great that President Obama said non-believers. I grew up in a very small town in the South as a Roman Catholic and was constantly ostracized by my peers in school when we would have school-sanctioned prayers because I didn't say the Lord's Prayer the same way they did. And so I know what it feels like to be on the outside, even though I am a believer. So I think if you're on the outside, it feels better being on the inside.
Whether you're a believer or a non-believer, we want to hear what you think. How did Obama's mention of atheists make you feel? Like an insider? Is including non-believers important? Does it matter? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
We're going to talk about a story that affects sub-Saharan Africa, where vision and eye care services are nearly non-existent. And when they are available, it's costly. The ratio of eye doctors to patients there is 1 million to 1. But one researcher at Oxford University has been working to make it easier for tens of millions of people around the world, including sub-Saharan Africa, to get help. Joshua Silver joins us from Oxford University, where he is the director of research at the Center for Vision in the Developing World. Hello, Joshua.
Hello.
So tell us about your plan.
Well, if you look at the world and you ask how many people need corrective eyewear today, the answer is probably 3 billion people. And my plan, if you like, the aim, is to try to deal with that problem over the next 10 years or so, if we possibly can.
So wait a second, though. You're a physicist. Yeah. And you've invented a kind of eyeglass that is self-adjusting. Explain.
Yeah. Well, you see, if you ask the question, why are there such large numbers of people that don't have corrective eyewear? The answer, as you've already alluded to, is that really they don't. There are insufficient eye care professionals to meet the needs of the people. And I looked at this problem and thought, well, how about if you can create eyeglasses where the lenses are not conventional, not fixed, but can be changed in power? And then how about you equip people with these eyeglasses and they adjust the lenses until they can see clearly, in effect making their own prescription eyewear?
So how does that work exactly, though? So you don't have a glass, I mean, there's no lens?
Well, there are actually, of course there's a lens, there are several ways of making lenses that have the feature that their focusing power can be easily changed. And in fact, we're all familiar with this, although we may not know it, because the lens inside your eye has the feature that it can change its focusing power. And normally, it's operated, as it were, automatically by the brain. And as you look around, the lens changes its focus so that you maintain good focus as you look at different distances. And if you extend that thought a bit, and if you think, well, suppose I made a lens a bit like the eye lens, actually make two of them, pop them into a spectacle frame, put a means of adjustment on them, then maybe the wearer could adjust those lenses, if they needed glasses, until they got clear vision.
It's fascinating that you're doing a kind of a design question mimicking what's going on in the human eye. I'm wondering how this initiative is different or similar to, say, the one laptop per child attempt to get technology like laptops to people in emerging countries, or the use of local technology to produce wheelchairs around the world that people have tried to use to get easily maintainable devices into communities of need there. I suspect you're going to need fresh water at the very least to make this work.
There is a similarity between all these programs, but you don't need the device comes sort of ready filled, and you simply put it on and you adjust it. You don't need anything else.
That's great.
And how many, Josh, have actually been distributed? And I understand that you have a very ambitious plan for 2010.
Yeah. Well, so far, the approach of what I would call self-refraction has been tested in the field with support from the British government's Department for International Development and shown to be effective, shown that it works. You can find your own refraction with the device. We've also put out around 30,000 pairs.
Josh, how much do they cost?
The device currently, we charge for the device, which most of which have been put out, in fact, by the U.S. government, with a little logo on the side saying "from the American people." We charge around $19-$20 for them at the moment. But the eventual aim is to bring the cost down to around a dollar. because if we don't do that, we can't really get to the volumes that we wish to get to.
And that brings you to your goal of getting these eyeglasses distributed to tens of millions of people by 2010.
We want to distribute initially, as the initial phase of the program, we want to distribute around 1 million over the next year or so.
Joshua Silver, we wish you all the best of luck. Joshua Silver is the Director of Research at the Center for Vision in the Developing World at Oxford University. Femi Oke now has headlines.
Thank you very much. Good morning. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. We're just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Investors have some new economic data to chew on this morning. New home construction sank to 550,000 in December, and that's the lowest since 1959. And last month, construction numbers went down almost 19%. The president, on his first day at work, introduced pay freezes for his top White House aides.
During this period of economic emergency, families are tightening their belts, and so should Washington. And that's why I am instituting a pay freeze on the salaries of my senior White House staff.
President Obama says that he wants government to be more open. He's instructing federal agencies to be more responsive to requests made under the Freedom of Information Act. He says the government shouldn't keep information secret out of fear of embarrassing public officials. Pakistan has a suspect in custody linked to the 2005 London Transit bombings. Zubi ul Taifi is a Saudi citizen, and Pakistani police picked him up in Islamabad. He was one of seven al-Qaeda suspects captured in a raid sparked by a tip from the US government. Senate Democrats are moving toward letting comedian Al Franken join the chamber provisionally while Republican Norm Coleman's election lawsuit is pending. The lawsuit is set to start on Monday, and it's not clear when Franken could be seated. He leads Coleman by 225 votes, so very close there. And finally, Microsoft is ready to cut up to 5,000 jobs. Profits have sagged amid a weak market for PCs, and this as weekly unemployment claims surge to their highest levels in more than a quarter of a century. And that news came out in just the last 60 minutes or so.
Yeah, and it's hurting the NASDAQ. It's down 35 points, and the Dow is down about 1.6% at this point in the early going.
Thank you very much for that update. And the jobless claims far exceeded what economists predicted today.
Bad economic news. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And actor Forrest Whitaker, my, you're up early.
I'm pleased to announce that the film selected as the Best Picture nominees for 2008 are...
They all get up early in Hollywood on this day. The 81st Academy Awards nomination ceremony was announced just about an hour ago. The big headline, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, led the way with 13 nominations. And the no surprise, Heath Ledger earned a supporting actor nomination on the one-year anniversary of his death for his role as the Joker in The Dark Knight. She got up with everyone else. Sharon Waxman, Takeaway contributor and editor-in-chief of a brand-new entertainment industry news site called TheWrap.com, which launches next week, joins us from the West Coast. Sharon, thanks for joining us. It appears that the cult favorite underdog is a slumdog.
Yeah, this year, well, we didn't know what it was going to be, and Slumdog had been gaining momentum, and it's not going to be the leader at the Oscars this year. It did get Best Picture, it did get Best Screenplay, and a lot of people in Hollywood really love it, but it looks like the Academy went for a great big budget, epic story, big stars in Ben Button's. They got 13 nominations. It's been a bunch of years since there's been one movie that's kind of dominated like that.
Well, let's talk about the actress nominations and the actor nominations quickly.
Sure. Well, we've got, I have to say, my very favorite nominations in the acting department is Angelina Jolie came up from behind, and she got a Best Actress for The Changeling because that performance had been overlooked, and so that means both Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie both got Best Acting nominations.
Huge.
There's a headline.
Yeah, ta-da, they're both going to come and be at the podium, possibly. But, of course, Mickey Rourke for The Wrestler, who's this very small movie. It won in Berlin, and not a lot of people have seen it, but it's a comeback tale, and the Academy loves that, and he got nominated. I have to tell you, my very favorite acting nomination, Robert Downey Jr. for Tropic Thunder for playing in blackface.
Wow, that, you know, I thought it was going to be for Iron Man. I couldn't tell when the nominations came out, but that's another comeback story right there.
Yeah, that's out of the blue. But also, the Academy never nominates comic performances, so this is really a departure. I mean, Iron Man would have been enough of a departure because it's not a serious film. But Tropic Thunder, that's really innovative.
There's a Kate Winslet story. She won big at the Golden Globes, but it's a little different here.
Yeah, right. She won twice at the Golden Globes for The Reader and Revolutionary Road, Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress. But she only got one nomination. She'll just have to be satisfied with a nomination for Revolutionary Road and not for The Reader, where she played a German woman.
And one more time, Sharon, Meryl Streep gets a nomination for Down.
You will never get me to say anything bad about Meryl Streep, but she is a perennial. Yep. There's a reason for it.
Last question quickly. What's the chance Milk could win, or The Wrestler could win, or Frost Nixon could win in the Best Picture category?
Well, now we'll have to see what happens. There's very subtle campaigning and not so subtle campaigning that goes on in the next 4 weeks before the Academy Awards. So I think it's perilous to predict today on nominations day. We've got to see what happens the next 4 weeks. Lots of skeletons can come out of the closet.
Well, and
there can be mudslinging.
You'll be reporting on all of those skeletons and all of the subtle shifts in the buzz there on therap.com, which launches next week. And editor in chief. Did you give yourself that job, or did somebody give you that job?
That's for another time. You hope your readers who are interested in the entertainment industry and how it works
will
tune in.
TheWrap.com. Sharon Waxman, thanks for joining us on the Oscar nominations day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 22nd, and Femi Okeh has some headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Diplomats are looking for a way to keep the Gaza ceasefire going. Top Israelis are in Egypt and Europe for talks. This as new violence broke out this morning. An Israeli gunboat off Gaza opened fire. Israel says it did so to deter a Palestinian ship that strayed out of bounds. But this low-level violence doesn't appear to be a threat to the greater ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. The UN's humanitarian chief, John Holmes, is taking a first-hand look at the damage caused by Israel's offensive in the Gaza Strip.
We've seen a school blown up, we've seen a flour mill hit. These are things which are terrible to see, profoundly shocking, and have profound implications for the economic future of Gaza. So that's why there's such a huge job to do.
John Holmes says that his biggest concerns are clean water, sanitation, electricity and shelter for those displaced by fighting. Leaders around the world are wishing President Obama well, but one is raising eyebrows. Fidel Castro wrote an essay praising the president's honesty. It's the first thing he's written in more than a month, and the lack of essays from the normally prolific writer fueled rumours that Castro had actually fallen into a coma. Argentina's president met with Castro yesterday, and she says he looked good and says, I'm going to quote here, believes in Obama, end of quote. And finally, Microsoft is ready to cut up to 5,000 jobs. Profits have sagged amid a weak market for PCs, and that's part of why Intel also plans to slash up to 6,000 jobs. And the chipmaker will close several factories and cut back production at others. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
So Castro is a believer, not a non-believer.
Yes, he's a believer in Obama.
In Obama.
Yes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So let's say somebody walked up to you and said, hey, here's $300 billion. And before the smile broke from your face, you'd probably think they're a little bit crazy. But the Obama administration is going to walk up almost literally to 300 million Americans or so, well, taxpayers anyway, and give them $300 billion in tax cuts. So the temptation would be to say, do whatever you want with the money. It's okay with us. But in fact, the economic stimulus package actually requires that Americans do some specific things with that money. Even if you do have $300 billion, how do you get people to do what you want them to do with money like that? And joining us is our predictably irrational fellow, Dan Ariely, who got up this morning to be on the program. It's irrational enough. But he's also the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you for having me so late in the program. It's great.
Yes, indeed. Steve, we're getting a little more rational with you. So Dan, how do you, as a matter of economics, encourage people to do something specific, say spend their tax cut versus save their tax cut or pay some bills with their tax cut money?
So it turns out that the way we frame the money we give people makes a very big difference. So think for yourself. Imagine that your job said you could get $30 extra every month, or you could get $300 at the end of the year as a bonus. How will that make you feel? How would you use the money differently? Now, what most people think is that if they gave the raise, if they got the raise that is monthly, they will kind of spend the money on bills. But if they got the money at the end of the year as a bonus, they will end up spending it on something big, different, frivolous. So it turns out that the way that we get money makes us feel differently. Or think about something else. What about if you found some money or if you got money as a gift from somebody? You would feel differently about that money. So what happened is that the way we get money influences how we spend it.
Well, the federal government doesn't have a whole lot. But the federal government doesn't have a lot of choices. I mean, they can just print money on green checks. That's all they can do. How do they make something look like a gift or feel like a bonus?
So there are multiple ways to do it. First of all, it turns out that the name that you give it can make a difference. Hmm. So Nick Epley, a very smart and clever psychologist, showed that if you give people money and you call it a rebate, people feel that that's their own money. It was their money. You just took it from me and you give it back to me. It's not a big deal. But if you call it a bonus or a gift, people think very differently about it. So just by calling it tax rebate, the argument goes, we're making people feel they're getting back their money and therefore there's no reason for them to spend it.
So you're more likely to save if it's called a rebate.
That's right. It was your money to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would go a step further. You know, one of the things we know is that when you assign money to a particular category and you separate it from the rest of your money, for example, if I gave you a gift certificate, people feel very good about spending that money. So one thing you can think about is ask the government to give us gift certificates. That, of course, is a bit complex. But imagine that the government gave us a debit card.
That
was preloaded with some amount of money, and it had the logo of the government, make a picture of Barack Obama smiling, and a statement that says, spend the government's money.
Oh, that's
interesting. If you held this thing in your pocket.
Technologically, that's easy to do, actually, isn't it?
Technologically, it's trivial to do, and I'm sure every credit card company would be very happy to help with this. But it would also separate this money from the regular pot of money that we have. It will make it separate, and then we would spend it much more easily. And on top of that, I think that Obama has this social capital right now that he could actually ask us to spend it on a specific thing that would make sense for the economy.
And you think he would
buy more American
and you think
make.
He would do it?
Well, you know, will he do it? You know, his speech gave us a lot of promise about this kind of social coordination of all of us, that kind of Kennedy-like speech in which we should all act in the best of the country. Now the question is, will he make some requests from us to do it?
Well, let's talk track record on that. I mean, during the 1970s, when the auto industry was in such trouble and there was also this paranoid concern about the Japanese, there were all kinds of calls from Washington to buy American cars. It didn't work.
Didn't work, and I'm not sure what was the record on Kennedy's request to start wearing sweaters.
But let me ask you this, Dan. That may be true, everything you've just laid out in terms of motivating behavior in general, but let's take the tax code specifically. The tax code is set up to influence behavior. Let's take charitable donations, for example, right? If you give donations, you get deductions. We're encouraging that behavior, and more people do it so that they can get those deductions.
That's right. So the tax code does have an effect. The question is, does it have a maximal effect that it has? So look, what's happening is that we're going to give a tax benefit to people. Let's say we're going to spend $200 billion. The question is, what value are you going to get out of it? you can get a smaller value if people spend a small proportion of it and deposit most of it in their checking account. And you could get more value out of it if you make people feel that they should spend more out of it. So it's basically a question of how do you take the same fixed pie and make it more usable.
But this account could be kind of dynamic. I mean, you could have this debit card that everybody gets, and then you go and look at your balance to see when they put an infusion into the stimulus program, and maybe infusion number one is one level, and they say, go buy this, and infusion number two is this other level. You get people sort of participating in the stimulus as opposed to simply taking a check down to the bank.
That's right. There could be all kinds of benefits. So one of the interesting things is that for the last 8 years, this is going to be the third time we're going to give people money back. The last two times didn't really work that well. We tried it once was, I think, 2000 maybe, and once in 2007. It didn't really work that well. So why are we expecting to do the same thing now and that all of a sudden it will work? That's the big mystery for me.
Would it work with different smiling faces on the debit card? I mean, you said Barack Obama's smiling face on the debit card, but we could have, you know.
Like who?
I don't know. Well, maybe you could get your own smiling face on the debit card.
your kids' money. But you know, I think there's a bigger point here, which is to say, is it correct to try and buy Americans into spending more money? And there's an intuition in which we have kind of a social norm around society of how much do we do for each other. And Americans in general are incredibly generous with their money and time in contributing. And one way to think about economic recession is a social coordination problem. You know, if we all think there's a recession and we all halt our spending and we all stop it, nobody will spend anything, and as a consequence, the economy will drop substantially. But if we all start believing that it's actually good for us to help each other, to donate, to help people in need, to buy more things, we could actually save the economy. It's so like a run on the bank.
So the idea of service, of everybody needing to do their part, is actually maybe a narrative in which Barack Obama could mobilize exactly the kind of behavior that you're talking about. We will see about the debit card, though. Dan Ariely, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Dan Ariely is the James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University and author of Predictably Irrational. And he joined us from Durham, North Carolina.
So a card with your smiling face on it, huh?
Yeah, it's going to save the economy.
It's going to save. That's our takeaway today. But also today, a lot of people still talking about President Obama's use of the word non-believer in his inaugural address.
When my fourth grader came home from school, who watched it at school, that was the one thing she could remember when I asked her what she thought about the speech. She thought it was so cool that Obama included non-believers. From a family that does not practice any organized religion, I found that extremely heartening that my 10-year-old daughter could feel included.
Do you believe or not believe? Did you notice that he said that? And what did you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. On our website, thetakeaway.org, there's more on the new administration. You can check that out. Also, the cabinet and the policies, the new policies of President Obama. I'm Adora Udoji.
Keep the conversation going. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.